Good afternoon, and welcome to the Jewish Policy Center webinar. I am Shoshana Bryant, Senior Director of the JPC, and your host. Our guest today is the truly outstanding Benham Bentalibu from the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. He's going to introduce us to some key players in the Iranian regime. As you probably know, Iran's president, Ibrahim El-Raisi, was one of four people on Iran's so-called Prosecution Committee, also known as the Death Committee, which was responsible for the execution of thousands of political prisoners in 1998. El-Raisi is sanctioned by the U.S. Office of Foreign Assets Control, but there are other people in Iran in the government who are not as much mentioned in the Western media, in the American press, who are also sanctioned, and they need to be better known. They will be better known if our guest has anything to say about it, and he has a lot to say about it. Before we get to Benham, here is your JPC commercial. We were established in 1985 as a 501c3 organization, providing analysis of foreign and domestic policies. You can find our website at jewishpolicycenter.org. There you can read our insight articles, our blog In Context, and our magazine In Focus Quarterly. The fall issue of In Focus is at the printer right now. It was supposed to be 9/11 plus 20 years, but the really poorly handled and deadly withdrawal from Afghanistan made us reconsider just a little bit. So grab a copy of In Focus when it comes out, either online or in a paper subscription, and see where we think and our authors think we're going in the future. The JPC supports a strong American defense capability, U.S.-Israel security cooperation, and missile defense, including and especially the defensive Iron Dome. We support the legitimacy and security of Israel against anyone who would deny them. As an organization that sits slightly to the right of center, we advocate on behalf of small government, low taxes, free trade, fiscal responsibility, and energy security, as well as free speech and intellectual diversity. In this series of webinars, we've been pleased to bring you scholars and policymakers on issues including Israel in various aspects, including the positive stuff, the Abraham Accords, and the negative stuff, the Hamas rocket war. We've done China, we've done Turkey, whose role in supporting the Muslim Brotherhood makes it a suspect ally, and Iran, and today we're returning to Iran. Your public service announcement, you are muted, you know that. But you can send your questions on the Q&A function on your Zoom screen. Q&A function, please, and we're monitoring those. So now to our speaker. Benham Bentalibu is Senior Fellow at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, where he focuses on Iranian security and political issues. Prior to his work at FTD, Benham worked on nonproliferation issues at an arms control think tank in Washington, which sounds a little suspect. Maybe we should ask him about that. Leveraging his subject matter expertise and his native Farsi skills, he has closely been tracking a wide range of Iran-related topics, including nuclear nonproliferation or proliferation, ballistic missiles, Iran sanctions, the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, and the foreign policy and security issues related to the Iranian Republic and internal Iranian politics, which is where we're going today, which means your questions can cover a lot of ground today. Frequently called on to brief journalists, congressional staff, and other Washington audiences, Benham has also testified before the U.S. Congress and the Canadian Congress. It's nice to think that our Canadian neighbors have some of the same questions we have. His analysis has been quoted everywhere you think it would be, including the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, Reuters, Fox News, AP, Agence France-Presse, and others. And he has contributed to Foreign Affairs, Foreign Policy, Fox News, The Hill, and War on the Rocks. If you don't read War on the Rocks, you should. He's appeared on a variety of broadcast programs, including BBC News, Fox News, CBS Interactive, C-SPAN, and Defense News. He earned his MA in International Relations from the University of Chicago and his BA in International Affairs and Middle East Studies from George Washington University here in Washington. Benham Bentalibu, the floor is yours.
Thank you so much, Shoshana, for that very kind and warm introduction. It's a real pleasure to be with you, as well as with everyone on the call here with the JPC. You had just been chatting with me earlier before we went live about how we'd known each other from our work. And really, I had known you and the work of your organization through your writings and through the In Focus publication. So it's really great to be able to collaborate here, and to everyone who took the time away from their busy, mid-pandemic, post-pandemic telework lifestyles to tune in and catch this live. Thank you for turning out to listen to what I think is a very important but somewhat underappreciated aspect of the larger Iran threat matrix, which is the men that make the threat that we know the Islamic Republic to be what it is today. So I want to begin at the top, and at the top does actually not mean beginning with the president of the Islamic Republic. It actually means beginning with someone whose title is meant to be taken rather literally, the supreme leader of the Islamic Republic. You know, the Islamic Republic has only had two supreme leaders. Again, it's a regime that's been around since 1979. The founding father of the Islamic Revolution and Islamic Republic was Ayatollah Khomeini. The second supreme leader is Ayatollah Khamenei. Khamenei is in the eighth decade of his life and third decade of his career being Iran's supreme leader. And that doesn't mean his worldview, his outlooks, his antics, his politics. It means that that stuff is not inclined to change anytime soon. And in fact, the more he's been inside this position, the more he's embraced a certain kind of Islamist authoritarianism and been less shy about putting that face of Islamist authoritarianism out into the world. The cabinet that exists today inside the Islamic Republic under this new president, someone who you know and then someone who Shoshana basically gave me the bottom line up front about, which is that this person in their late 20s served in what we like to call the Iranian injustice system, not the Iranian justice system. And at the tail end of the Iran-Iraq War in 1988, Raisi was part of this four-person death commission implementing essentially two fatwas against political prisoners in Iran, some of whom were even serving much lesser sentences. And in essence, through a bureaucratic process of implementing those two fatwas, paved the way for them to die, basically signed off on their murder, was part of the bureaucratic judicial legal process that led them to their deaths. When you listen to the tapes that actually have come out from protests from within famous clerics like Ayatollah Montazeri, who was supposed to become Iran's second supreme leader, but who was essentially sent to house arrest after he had a falling out with the founding father of the Islamic Republic over this very criminal act, the murder of political prisoners in 1988, you see some of the other justices begin to make religious defenses, political, legal, security defenses for the murder of these political prisoners. But Raisi's voice is not really heard there. And I have to thank many of my friends and colleagues for passing along this tape to me a little while ago and bringing it to my attention, because it shows you kind of like we've known in other contexts, particularly, and Hannah Arendt said this brilliantly, I believe, about the banality of evil, how routinized evil had become. And when you look at someone's career like Raisi, the evil that he's brought upon the Iranian population has been systematically routinized, because he was promoted multiple times across the Iranian injustice system after proving his revolutionary gravitas at such a young age. Attaining multiple positions, and in 2019 became the country's the head of the country's judiciary, as we said again, the head of the country's injustice system, before becoming president in 2021. Now, his presidency, becoming president in 2021, did not exist in a political vacuum. He is part of a political project by that more important force, the country's supreme leader, Ali Khamenei, to increasingly narrow what is an already narrow political spectrum. You know, this is an Islamist authoritarian regime. We've said that. They've proved that, not just through their act, the rhetoric, but through their actions over the past four decades. But they've proved that with the people that they've promoted. So rather than accountability for Raisi's crimes, he's promoted to the highest echelons of power. And really starting in 2005, what Khamenei, the country's current supreme leader, has done, and when we talk about him kind of coming into his own, is that he prevented a former president from running. The previous president from 1997 to 2004-5, it was a reformist president who had two terms. There were very famous reformist street protests in Tehran in 1999 and lingering protests a few years after that affiliated with Tehran University. Those were crushed violently by the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps and law enforcement forces, otherwise known as the police. But Khamenei wanted to put an end to the even limited political project of reform inside the Islamic Republic. And while he was successful at doing that, what you've seen now from the Iranian population is a move from away from reform and much more towards revolution, which best explains the multiple uprisings and multiple wide scale, geographically and demographically diverse protests we've seen inside the Islamic Republic from 2017 up until, you know, present, really. But going back to this political project, Khamenei had increasingly cut out those left those different strands of supporters of Islamist authoritarianism in Iran, basically those that wanted more engagement with the outside world, and narrowed the political spectrum. And as he narrowed this spectrum, began to introduce generations of hardliners. In 2005, as you know, Ahmadinejad, the former polyester-clad zip-up jacket wearing presidents before the UNGA of Iran, who used every public opportunity available to him to claim that the Holocaust didn't exist and to call for the eradication of Israel, that guy became president. And then in 2013, Rouhani became president. And Rouhani was billed in the West as a moderate. And the regime went to great lengths to feign moderation, to capitalize on all the escalation that happened in the 8 years of the Ahmadinejad period from 2005 to 2013, all of the regime's nefarious regional activities, all of the escalation in Iraq and Syria and Afghanistan, all of the arms trafficking, and most importantly, all of the nuclear escalation, the illicit domestic enrichment, the violation of five UN Security Council resolution, the testing and transfers of ballistic missiles, the production of nuclear-capable ballistic missiles, the adding to of the lethality of that notorious terrorist force, the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, unleashing its long arm abroad with terrorist attacks that kill people in far-off places like Bulgaria, for instance, kills several Israeli tourists there because of their support to Hezbollah operatives, which did a bus bombing there. Their attempts to do similar attacks in places like Thailand and even India, if I'm not mistaken, then. And then all of a sudden have this new face, this Rouhani, this alleged moderate face come in and bring in a cabinet, a constellation of men who their claim to fame was that they had many, many, many PhDs, PhDs from Western and foreign institutions. And they use this constellation of political figures to feign moderation, moderation that most unfortunately, you know, Western governments bought, moderation that most unfortunately many in the Western media bought, and that got them the interim nuclear deal of 2013, which began the process of relieving sanctions and led ultimately to the final nuclear deal of 2015, which was known as the JCPOA. And now the regime is confident that even though the Trump administration left the deal and now the Biden team is in, now the regime is feeling confident that sanctions relief is coming. So the constellation of power it has today is the hardest of the hardliners. It's the culmination of the political project of narrowing the political spectrum and introducing these hardest of hardliners into key positions. One, because they feel so confident that sanctions relief is coming, they simply don't need to pretend anymore. Two, is that Khamenei, who is in the eighth decade of his life, third decade of his career, wants this ultra hardline constellation at the helm if and when he does pass. And three, it tells you what he wants the regime to look like in the next iteration. When you look at the people in the Raisi cabinet, it is the most sanctioned cabinet, and not just by the US, but by the UN, the United Kingdom, the European Union, and it even has two wanted persons from Interpol. who were part of the bombing of a Jewish community center in Buenos Aires, Argentina, that killed 85 people in 1994. One of them is an executive vice president, and the other one, I believe, is Minister of Interior. Both of them used to don the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps uniform in the past and were generals in that sanctioned terrorist organization. So Raisi, Khamenei is comfortable tapping these sorts of people to be in Raisi's cabinet. And even though, you know, we believe that a president chooses his cabinet, what was unveiled in the Persian language press earlier this summer was that the speaker of Iran's parliament during confirmation hearings about the cabinet let out an open secret that really the supreme leader is the one who taps these individuals for their very sensitive positions. So you have a constellation of power in Iran today where even the Europeans have sanctioned these people for human rights abuses and for their proliferation sensitive activities related to WMD and or their delivery vehicles. The US has sanctioned many more than any other political entity of this cabinet. But if you look very closely, the authority under which the US has sanctioned most of Raisi's cabinet is not a terrorism-related authority. It is not a human rights-related authority. It is not a counter-proliferation-related authority. It is actually a very wide catch-all political authority that was created by the Trump administration in 2019 that is designed to sanction anyone appointed to a position of official business inside the regime or someone that serves in Khamenei's office or inner network. So it's basically designed to name, shame, and target the supreme leader of Iran's network. And it is actually under this authority that Raisi, the president of Iran, is sanctioned. He is ironically not yet sanctioned in the US under human rights authorities, despite his vast history of human rights abuses. Something scary about this constellation of power. And I want to begin to turn it over to the audience for questions, because I believe Shoshana said that you guys have been passing along questions, is that many of these penalties might come off. For instance, the European Union and the United Kingdom, which have these counter-proliferation sanctions against people in this cabinet, if all else goes as it's going today, will be removing many of these proliferators and supporters of Iran's nuclear and missile program from their sanctions list, pursuant to their adherence still to that fatally flawed nuclear deal, the 2015 nuclear deal known as the JCPOA. This is going to create sanctions enforcement issues between us and our allies, because many of those remain on US sanctions lists. Conversely, the European Union has actually issued more human rights sanctions against people in Raisi's cabinet than the US has. So the US has some catching up to do when it comes to human rights authorities. But if you listen to what the Iranian former Iranian foreign minister Javad Zarif and the official report that Javad Zarif's foreign ministry gave to the parliament earlier this summer, that in the six rounds of indirect diplomacy between the Biden administration and the outgoing Rouhani administration, the Americans had allegedly, and again, this is an Iranian claim, allegedly agreed that in a final diplomatic agreement, they would be removing that very same broad catch-all authority that goes after Khamenei's inner network and network of political appointees inside Iran. So that would mean someone like Raisi would be sanctions-free. Worse, in that same document that the Iranian foreign ministry this summer gave to parliament about those indirect nuclear negotiations, it also alleged that Washington was going to be willing to remove the FTO, or the Foreign Terrorist Organization label of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. And we proved that many inside the cabinet have worked with, liaised with, even Iran's current foreign minister, for instance, is known to have close ties with the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, even though he's never donned the uniform. There's three former generals of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps in the cabinet today. There's many people who come from the parastatal or bunyads, or the kind of the tax-free charitable foundations that actually function as slush funds inside the Islamic Republic to move money around and to fund terrorism. Many of these guys are tied to the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, and some of them would receive sanctions relief in the future. So it's one big mess. But the key points I want you to know before we pivot to questions is that this is the culmination of the narrowing of the political space inside Iran, It is a very cohesive cabinet, but at the same time, it draws from a very, very, very narrow bench inside Iran, meaning that even the acceptable pool of elites are narrowing for the supreme leader of Iran, Ali Khamenei. And at the same time that we have this ultra hardline, escalation ready, conflict prone, contestation ready constellation of individuals in Tehran, ready to put the pedal to the metal, we actually have a constellation of people here in Washington who, with immense respect, are trying to do everything to, as it appears to be, appease these folks or actually try to buy them out with sanctions relief or try to turn a blind eye to some of their malign activities to resurrect a deal for political or strategic reasons. And at a time when the U.S. appears to be trying to de-escalate and pivot from the region, perhaps all too plainly given the botched Afghanistan withdrawal, you have a group of people in Iran who are trying to make it look like the U.S. is going to be kicked out of the region. And this will have ramifications for the region. This will have ramifications for Iran's ultimate quest for a nuclear weapon. And of course, this will have ramifications for the U.S., for Israel, and its other allies in the region. I know this was a lot of ground to cover, but I look forward to unpacking many of these threads with you in the questions to follow.
That is a lot to unpack. Fortunately, listeners have helped us with questions. So you have a lot of people who are sanctioned by a lot of different organizations and entities and countries, and yet they seem to appear all over the place doing Iranian diplomacy. First of all, how hard is it for them to go out and do diplomacy, even if they're under sanction? And secondly, if we're not stopping them, what do we need to do that we haven't done yet? How do we make their lives difficult?
Well, it's interesting to note that the country's foreign minister, for instance, is not subject to sanctions. He's never formally worked for the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, but he's worked alongside them, meaning he's not donned the uniform. He's not a veteran like others are, but he's worked alongside them. So depending on how broad, you know, you count the term agent or affiliate or partner of a sanctioned terrorist organization, you could potentially cast a wider net. But the problem right now that we're facing is not a definitional problem, it's a strategic problem. Because when the Biden administration came in, one of the earlier things it did is that it actually unwound some of the travel restrictions for Iranian diplomats who are even traveling to the UN in New York, for instance. So that is one major impediment. I'm sure many remember the scenes from, I think it was the NYPD impeding Iran's former foreign minister Zarif from crossing from one side of the street to the other. I believe some of those regulations have been unwound by the Biden team. So that kind of biggest piece has already been taken off the board. With the rest of them, those who have asset freezes and travel bans, those are still in place. Not all of these ultra hardliners travel. The unsanctioned one, you know, Abdullahian, the foreign minister of Iran, he does travel. He travels quite a bit. He went to Iraq recently. I believe he was in Moscow recently as well, talking about indirect, nuclear diplomacy again. He's talking about trying to kickstart the talks that led to the JCPOA. So some of them do travel, some of them don't travel. But I would, you know, think about, you know, market conditions being the biggest thing. We also remember, for instance, the wave of airports and airport service providers in Europe who would not provide service to sanctioned Iranian airlines, given their support for terrorism, WMD proliferation, or Iran's activities in Syria. It's that kind of environment that can name, shame, and punish banks, businesses, and even people that support Iran's nefarious activities. But that requires political will. And given what we saw early on in the administration, taking that big piece off the chessboard, that doesn't necessarily seem to be there. Many penalties remain on the books today. I will give them credit for that. But it's all about enforcement.
There are many people who want you to comment on political will, but I think we'll hold that for a minute. We have two related questions on China in this. One is that China has never been a supporter of sanctions. And with Europe considering easing sanctions and the US considering easing sanctions, is China going to emerge a winner here is one question. And how much should we worry about that? And secondly, though, the United States allows NGOs and other charitable organizations to operate in Iran theoretically to help the Iranian people, theoretically not to help the Iranian government. But organizations like the Confucius organizations, which are Chinese, they're helping the government I don't want to say evade sanctions, but they're helping them get around sanctions by trying to mitigate the problems to the people as well as paying the government. So what's our biggest problem with China and Iran? And is there a separate way to address that?
So on the NGO, IGO, IO side, I'm not the best scholar on that. So I probably won't be able to give your readers, your viewers the best answer. Both in the U.S. side, if there's things from like the Goethe Institute, is that the long arm of Germany? That's definitely not my domain of expertise. But what I will focus on is, of course, the Chinese foreign policy angle as it relates to Iran, because this is where the great power competition that the Trump administration talked about, that the Biden administration talked about, that's where both sides of the aisle need to understand great power competition has a regional element to it. The Cold War between the U.S. and the USSR was cold directly on each other's territories, but was hot around the globe. So we have to understand that this new political contest is going to be hot around the globe. And in this sense, you have to look at the data. And in the Obama era and in the Trump era, in their pre-sanctions of the Obama and the post-sanctions of Obama, and the pre-sanctions of Trump and the post-sanctions of Trump, the macroeconomic data tells you one thing: China remains the largest licit and illicit importer slash purchaser of Iranian oil. This is a problem. The regime in Iran, if you are focusing on macroeconomic contraction, making them feel the economic pain, it necessarily means cracking down on the network of banks, businesses, people that sell, supply, transfer, insure, refine, and move this oil. And that, again, requires political will. So even if the administration wants to enforce some of these penalties at a lower level, like you could say, not the banking and financial, but the shipping and sales, for instance, the shipping and the transferring and the refining, you could do that. But one reason that the Chinese see this as a win-win situation is that right now, the more they support Iran, and the data proves that in late 2020, so one could say a month or so after the election, the Chinese have been picking up their imports of Iranian oil, because this is the way markets work and this is the way politics work. You understand where your adversary is going and you want to make them pay the greatest political price. So the Chinese have not only begun to import more oil or get more oil, but they understand that the more they do this, the more that they could eventually use Iran as a chip in their larger game of competition with the West. This is how the other two near peer competitors, Russia and China, have always used Iran. The sad thing about Iran, and this is why the previous administration, when they said this multiple times, it was a welcome point by the Iranian diaspora, which is that the longest suffering victims of the regime in Iran are the Iranian people. Because this is a regime that, on its foreign ministry says neither East nor West, but in reality, for the past decade and a half, has been selling itself to the East in order to continue to fight the West. And they are increasingly willing to play the role of pawn to these other two countries to be sacrificed at the right moment, just because they share this ideological disposition that makes them all anti-American. So China, in the short term, wins because it gets the more oil imports. Some of them are sanctions free. The U.S. has done a couple of shots across the bow this summer. I'll give them credit, particularly the Treasury Department. You could look at the press releases there that have talked about and ultimately enforced these existing oil sanctions. But this stuff needs to be continuous and enforced in order to have the Chinese get the message. But even when they get the message, the Chinese are willing, it may again engage in this kind of game of horse trading. And the thing is, if the Chinese do move towards you on Iran, and it seems like the American ask is going to be to support the JCPOA, which would be, not the most worthwhile ask, because you're spending your political capital to resurrect something that has diminishing utility, that the Chinese would ultimately sell out Iran. And what the question is, what would the Americans give them? So what would the U.S. have to turn a blind eye to in order to get Chinese buy-in? And this is something a China scholar would have to answer.
I would just add two things. First of all, to note that Iran also exports Iraqi oil, because Iraqi oil is not under sanction, but it does add to the Iranian coffers. So it's just a point, when you talk about Iraq and Iraq policy and Iraq money and Iraq, it's running through Iran, number one. And number two, my great fear is that China will ask for Taiwan as its price. So I don't know that that's true, but I spent a fair amount of time on China and I suspect it is true. But you've opened the door.
Can I add a footnote just to the Taiwan bit? I'm sure all the viewers were following the stories from this weekend about the, you know, the airspace penetration and the Chinese fighter jets going closer and closer to Taiwan. You know, these things happen for a reason. Strategic defeat, America ending its longest war in the way that it did, doesn't exist in a political vacuum. Our adversaries are watching this. In Iran, which is, you know, compared to China, nowhere is capable. Khamenei is saying that this is a lesson for other countries, what happened in Afghanistan. The head of Iran's armed forces, General Staff, is saying that this is a sign of America's accelerating defeat or decline. Imagine what the Chinese are saying. And the Chinese understand this regional element of great power competition. And to the Americans, I would say the world doesn't work in that kind of stovepipe fashion. You can't pivot from losing a war to trying to have the same team of people at the helm and think you can signal resolve to a greater adversary when you signaled irresolution to a weaker adversary. And I would expect more of the kind of stuff that we saw against Taiwan. And Taiwan here is quite vulnerable.
I think that's absolutely right. So even though you didn't want to talk about China.
Sorry, you got
Taiwan. I think you're absolutely right because it fits into the pattern of things that we're talking about. And you can't ignore the patterns. If it works in one part of the world, it's liable to work in another part. And thank you. I think it was a great answer. You also opened the door to this conversation that we're going to have next, which is about opposition inside of Iran and the kind of opposition that remains. And we know that in 2019, there were a lot of demonstrations and riots. And unlike the ones in 2008 and 2009, these were not just in Tehran. These were around the country. These were different groups of people. And it really looked like the people had arisen against their government. Then comes COVID. Then comes all kinds of other things that couldn't attach to COVID that, you know, where are we now? Where are the people?
So this summer, again, the people's voices the people attempted to, I should say, have their voices heard. I don't know how loudly it was heard in Washington. Khuzestan, Iran's southwestern province, which is majority but not exclusively Arab, has been protesting on and off since 2011, part of the Arab Spring, 2015, 2014, due to major pollution in that area. There was a famous trending hashtag, Khuzestan can't breathe. But again, in 2021, that southwestern key province led a series of protests that spilled out of the southwest, citing initially environmental concerns to begin to make a larger political point. And that's the trend in protests that we see from 2017 and onwards, which is that the Iranian people will use an economic grievance, a social grievance, to begin to make a larger political point, which is that this regime does not represent them. And this is part of that fundamental transformation. And I'm very happy you drew that line in the sand between 2008 and 2009, the Green Movement, and the much more recent protests, which is the 1999 and the 2009. That decade is when political events, the closure of a newspaper, the stealing of an election, brings people onto the street to begin to make a claim for one part of the Iranian political spectrum, that, again, increasingly narrow spectrum, which brings authoritarian Islamists, but of slightly different stripes, to the fore. The people have pushed away from that, and you can tell this by their slogans. There's a famous Persian slogan, Esla Talab Usul Yara Dige Tamo Memajira, which is like, reformist, principalist, the game is up, or the jig is up. That it's kind of saying like, damn you and damn you. It's a plague upon both your houses, if you will, if we can borrow from Shakespeare here. And that has been the trend in the 2017 to present protests. It's geography, as you mentioned, much more widespread, not just limited to urban centers. In fact, these are outside in protest. The driving force on this are the urban and rural poor, economically, politically, and socially. This is what the regime had wanted to be, the next generation of the revolution, to sustain that revolutionary fervor. And these are the people that the regime thought they would buy off through handouts, but when there's less money to hand out and you continue to act like the regime acts both at home and abroad, you know, subsidies decrease, these people don't get money, but also the areas they live become more and more impoverished. And in this sense, the margins always bear the brunt. And they bear the brunt the hardest when the regime uses those diminishing assets, even less so at home and even more so abroad, which is why you have Iranians increasingly begin to use foreign policy in these protests as a vector of criticism. For instance, from 2009 to present, you had the slogan, not Gaza, not Lebanon, my life for Iran. 2017, if I'm not mistaken, you had the slogan, and it continues on. Forget Syria, think about us. So in many ways, the geography, demography, slogans, and political aims of post-2017 protests, which again manifested into the 2021 one, are distinctly nationalist. And the thing it's showing you is that it's a nationalist protest against the Islamist regime. And the big takeaway is, yes, the regime still uses mass violence, as you saw in 2009, and is using these other newfound cyber domestic tools, shutting down the internet for 6.5, 7 days in 2019. You know, the Washington Post has that famous saying, democracy dies in the darkness, or that tag, democracy dies in the darkness. You know, in 2019, the Iranian people died in the darkness. The thing is, now in 2021, there were internet blackouts, but the story was out there. Their voice was heard by many, but it wasn't heard by all. And in this sense, the administration was super slow to respond. I think it took several days to even acknowledge the fact that there are these protests. And I think that's a strategic mistake, because you don't have a lot of places in the Middle East. Israel is one, but Iran is definitely another, where you actually have a confluence of strategy and values. And you should never miss those opportunities to marry those two forces up. Because a lot of the times on a lot of other threat issues, you don't always get to have that nice marriage. And in this sense, you did. And again, we missed it.
So this led to some questions. Iran is a country which has lots and lots of subgroups in it, and lots of ethnic diversity and other sorts of things. So is it possible that these groups will start wanting to pull away from the center? In other words, create the possibility that Iran will come apart. Specifically, then we had a question about the people of Azerbaijan, or the Azeris inside of Iran, and that seems to have deteriorated recently. The relationship between the Iranian government and Azerbaijan, is that partly because of a pull from the internal Azeris? And the other part of that question, or the other question that goes with that, is after 40 years of Shiite theocracy, it appears, or we're led to understand, that a lot of regular Iranians who are Muslims reject the form of Islam being put upon them by their government, and either proclaiming themselves to be secular or Zoroastrian or something else to differentiate themselves from the kind of Islam that the regime promotes. Are those sorts of things, and I know the Baluch in the south of Iran have always wanted to come apart from the country, is there any possibility that these kinds of strains will collapse the center?
So these two different vectors, religion and ethnicity, are very, very important. And sometimes they coincide, they'll overlap, such as in Kurdistan, for instance, which is in Iran's western area, it borders Iraq, which borders into Iraqi Kurdistan. You have ethnic and religious minority. In Baluchistan, which is in Iran's southeast, you have ethnic and religious minority. You have ethnic Baluch as well as Sunni. But I would not conflate center periphery issues with secession issues, because these are actually arguments the regime likes to have come to the fore. Iran is a very ancient nation. It's not just Persian civilization, it's Iranian civilization. And one of the things I always like to say, and I never use the word Iranian regime for a reason, is that there is nothing Iranian about this regime. I am, you know, a proud member of the Iranian diaspora. I'm born and raised here in the States. But if you look at my last name, there is an ethnic Azeri component to that last name. But I am not someone who is in favor of, you know, drawing arbitrary lines in the sand. I think, you know, the past century in the Middle East is proof that that stuff doesn't necessarily work, particularly when you don't have the will to enforce those lines. And then, of course, you forget that, you know, many of these, for instance, twice in the past in Iran's history, both the Kurdistan one and the Azerbaijan one, were supported by Soviet insurrectionists. So the situation that you saw with the Iron Curtain coming down in Eastern Europe, you had the Soviets try to do just south of the Caucasus in Iran at the very beginning of the Cold War. And it was something that ultimately the U.S. stepped in and the U.N. Security Council stepped in, and Iran's territorial integrity remained intact. Those are important lessons to draw, but they're not the only guiding light for today, which is, I'm sure, the Islamist authoritarianism of the Islamic Republic has driven people who have multiple identities. So they're Iranian citizens, but they're not part of the major first ethnic subgroup, which is Persian, to embrace a different ethno-national identity, speaking their mother tongue. You know, many of these individuals face discrimination. But that doesn't necessarily mean that you can't have multiple identities. So I would be very careful, because the regime would want to conflate anyone who is an ethnic minority protesting for greater rights as an outright secessionist, to use the heavy-handed policies that they do in places like Baluchistan, Khuzestan, or elsewhere. The Azeris are a very important part of this equation. I mean, the sovereign state of Azerbaijan now, transitioning from this ethnic component to the foreign policy components because of Iran's support to Armenia in the 1990s in the Nagorno-Karabakh War. And ultimately, Iran's, again, support to Armenia in a much more recent iteration of fighting. You know, the traditional constellation is Turkey, Azerbaijan versus Iran, Russia, Armenia. And in this instance, it's very clear to me that Iran is the biggest loser of the more recent iteration of fighting in the Caucasus. Azerbaijan also historically has much closer ties, not historically, but in the past couple of decades has had much close ties to Israel. That is something that the regime is very, very afraid of. And it's something that is leading them to do these military exercises very close to the Azerbaijan border. I believe very recently the Azeris and the Turks had held some kind of united military drill on their side of the border as well. There is a key ethnic component to this, but there's also the foreign policy component to this. But the big takeaway I would have for your audience is, yes, there are ethnic minorities protesting, but the big trend is for Iranian nationalism, not for a separate ethno-nationalism. That is a component, but it's nowhere the loudest voice. For instance, in Khuzestan this summer, you had Arabs protesting, but with one voice, and they were joined by another ethnic group, Lors, which is a sub-ethnic group in Iran. And they were also protesting the same thing. Center-periphery issues shouldn't always be conflated with places where there is ethnic discrimination, but at the same time, it's an area to watch, because the longer this regime is around, the more I would suspect you would have that very hard pull from the center and a quest to find something else to embrace. And that quest to find something else to embrace dovetails very neatly into your second question, which is the religion crisis, which is indeed very much a crisis for the Islamic Republic, given that their attempts to fight back the secularism of the state they inherited of the Pahlavi dynasty, which was secular and nationalist, is in essence failing. They only have hard power to enforce things like the hijab, the mandatory veiling of women. And you've seen the kind of discrimination that exists against women in Iran today. There was just a story recently about trying to have a registry of women who are pregnant, for instance. This is the kind of abuse that the Iranian women have been taking for 4 decades, most unfortunately. But there is a very strong pull away from the religiosity, particularly the radical Khomeinist interpretation of 12er Shiism, which is the national religion or the official religion, you could say, of Iran. And the big, you know, in terms of conversion or lapsing, the big faiths out there have been away from the family kind of lines of 12er Shiism. Has been kind of a neo-Protestantism, Protestant groups, atheist, agnostic, and as you mentioned, Zoroastrian as well. As in, people have been kind of fleeing this one kind of inherited faith, given that faith's marriage with the authoritarian political power of the state. I hope I covered that issue.
No, it's great. I do that a lot, just one of these big things. So we're coming to the end of our program, and people who listen regularly or occasionally, I hope you'll all be regular listeners, know that I like to end with a question, the answer to which is positive, because I like to leave things on a positive note. I'm going to jump off a cliff here, though, because I'm not sure if your answer is going to be positive or negative. Here is our question from a listener. Is the United States, specifically USIA or Voice of America or any of those, or Radio Farda, are they doing anything meaningful to help the people, to undermine or delegitimize the regime? Are they good guys?
In the net effect, they have to be good guys, but they're not being as good as they can be. This is, my humble criticism. I've done interviews on many of those stations before. I have friends who work there, but I think they could always be doing much better. A couple of things for us who have criticisms to keep in mind is that, you know, this debate, it's a political debate in Washington over the firewall, meaning that, you know, how much of a forward-leaning information agency slash, you know, pusher of the U.S. foreign policy message should these institutions be versus like a merely news reporting organization. So that's a political debate Washington continues to have and will, I think, continue to have in the future. But one reason, regardless of that debate, and I want to sidestep it because it has been something of a partisan debate, but it need not be, is the debate over how effective it is because of the growth of other stations. You know, Manoto is a very popular station. Iran International is a very popular station. For a while, BBC Persian had a very significant popular following. These stations have been able to become what they've become today because of that deficit, the programming deficit that exists, both in terms of engaging content and both in terms of hard news of U.S. government-funded broadcasters. I still think there's a very key role for surrogate news, but I also think that there has to be some kind of stepping up. And I'm a little bit disappointed because I saw some metrics that were disappointing that were forwarded to me from a friend who was on Twitter. Sadly, I don't have Twitter, but I do get to see some of the things that are out there when people send things my way. Is about the declining lack of followers on VOA Persians. I forget if it was Instagram or Facebook or another kind of social media page that they had been moving away from it. And that means that the tool is not reaching the same audience that it was reaching before. You know, there is very much a need, especially if you're someone like me who looks at, you know, the Iranian press every day and you see the things that are, you know, sins of commission, sins of omission by the regime's own semi-official media, as well as their official media, as well as their kind of like politically affiliated authoritarian newspaper systems, which has tons of red lines and censors. There is tons of things there for US government programming to be able to exploit and to be able to say, hey, this is where you're being lied to. Hey, this is where you have narrative being pushed on you. Hey, this is actually where we're not doing this. And the Iranian people understand that, but I think ultimately, it's a deficit for us to not be able to do it much better. So it's a good tool, but it needs to be a much better tool. So I don't know if that's ending on a positive note or
it's kind of a waffle. It's kind of a waffle in terms of positive and negative. I'm going to call it a positive in the sense that there's a lot of room for us to grow. You know, so I'm just going to say that it's a positive answer because you've shown us a way. You've shown us what needs to be done. I mean, we know this. We are not as good as we should be, but we could be. And I guess that's positive.
And I'll take it. I'm happy to, in that sense, I'm happy to end on a positive. But there's people who study this much more closely than I. You know, when I'm looking at U.S. policy towards Iran, that the messaging is not always the thing I'm looking at. You know, it's more actions and, you know, official messaging versus the U.S. media domain vis-a-vis the Islamic Republic. But it can and should be a growth industry, regardless of your criticism. If you're pro, if you're anti, if you think there's more or less to be done, it should be a growth industry. That's where, you know, everyone, all sides of the aisle can meet. This is a tool that taxpayers are funding. It has to be good.
That's a great place to stop. And let me thank you, Benham Bentalibu. This has been a very enlightening, not totally happy, but terribly enlightening program. And I think we're all better off for having had the time to listen to you. So thank you so very much. And thank you to everyone who tuned in. We will be back with you next week with Richard Eidemann, who has a new book on anti-Semitism. And I think you probably want to tune in for that. We'll give you details soon. Thank you, everybody. Have a good day.